You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Hello, this is Holly Sonnenlund with ASCOA Online. It should have made sense that 52 years of civil war would not be easily or quickly ended. But nevertheless, when the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, also known as the FARC, signed a peace agreement in the fall of 2016, the international headlines rang out, Colombia is at peace. Except it wasn't. Days later, voters rejected the agreement, laying bare deep divides within a long-suffering Colombian society. Eventually, a revised agreement was signed and passed into Colombian law. So where do things stand today? How far or near, in fact, is Colombia from peace? For this, I talked with Virginia Bouvier, a senior advisor for peace processes at the United States Institute of Peace and an expert on Colombia's peace process. In our conversation, we talked about the inner workings of the peace agreement's implementation, the role the international community can play, and how things like next year's presidential elections and the weather are affecting the peace process. Dr. Bouvier, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Delighted to be here.
I wanted to start out by talking about the mudslides and flooding that hit southwestern Colombia in recent weeks, which left hundreds of fatalities and many, many more displaced. How has President Juan Manuel Santos responded, and how does this response compare historically to the government's attention to these rural areas?
Well, President Santos was on the first plane out to try to assess the situation and figure out what the best means forward was, and he immediately assigned his defense minister to be the point person on thinking about addressing the needs of the many people who've now been displaced or who are disappeared and have yet to be located, large numbers that were killed, some in hospitals now. But you have a huge situation where schools have been destroyed, hospitals have been destroyed, the few that were there. So there was not much infrastructure to start, and what little there was has been harmed. So I think he's trying to help re-engage the population and start on the road to recovery. This is unusual in the sense that Mocoa is just the kind of zone that's considered the kind of forgotten part of Colombia. These are the rural areas that have few state services to start with, that don't have the kinds of infrastructure that are required to really engage fully with the national environment and with the international community. They're often neglected by the state. And I think that in the light of the peace agreements that were signed, where there's great attention given to trying to bridge the divide between this other Colombia, this Colombia that's not really fully integrated into the citizenry of Colombia, and the more well-off sections of, you know, urban cities and kind of a middle-income country, I think it's the accord seeks to bridge the gap between the urban and rural divide, and I think that Putumayo represents a part of that rural area that desperately needs social services and basic services, electricity, light, to say nothing of schools or courts or hospitals.
So where are we in that peace process with the FARC? What has happened in the months since the Santos administration and the FARC signed that revised peace agreement?
So we've come full circle. We have a revised peace accord after the first one was rejected in the plebiscite back in October. And the new accord was the result of tremendous consultation with all of the different sectors of Colombian society. And once the consultations were over, the parties went back to the table in Havana and they wrote up another deal that was a little bit different from the first one. Once a second peace accord had been agreed to by the parties, it was presented to the Congress, which approved it. And then, not without opposition, there were tremendous debates in the Congress. There's still a very divided society in Colombia about what the terms of the agreement are and what it means for them. But once it was ratified by Congress, it went to the decision went to the Supreme Court to ensure that it was a constitutional decision. Everything that's approved in the Congress, if it has a question of constitutionality or not, is reviewed by the Supreme Court. It goes to the Constitutional Court. So the Constitutional Court signed off on it and granted the president fast-track authority, which basically means that any of the provisions that are in the peace accord that would require a congressional regulation would need to go through four rounds of debates, rather than the 8 rounds of debates that's traditionally required for changing the laws. So the fast-track authority was granted to President Santos. He was also granted a number of executive powers to approve legislation or to issue decree laws that would have the force of law as part of the implementation of the peace accords that had now been ratified. And you have an amnesty law that was approved a few months back that allowed the demobilizing FARC combatants to actually move into the zones without fear of being arrested. The arrest warrants have been suspended only for those who have not committed serious war crimes or crimes against humanity.
So the peace agreement now is a part of Colombian law. What are the other arenas in which peace is being worked out?
So there are kind of a couple of levels where the peace process is moving forward. One is the legal realm of creating the legislation and the procedures to be able to begin implementation of the peace agreements. The second area is actually demobilizing and disarming the FARC and equipping them to become citizens. And that's taking place largely in these zones in rural areas throughout Colombia. In addition to the 6,800 some people who have now been registered with the government as being located in the zones, there are also a number of about 1,500 members of the FARC who were in the militias. They were not official, you know, gun-carrying members, but they were supporters of the FARC enterprise, and their names have also been turned in so that they might be eligible for benefits. The government has announced that it is expecting another list to be forthcoming, that these are not the entirety of those who are at the camps or of those who are to be included in the demobilization process.
And what are these demobilization zones like? How has the rollout been?
There have been many problems with the zones, with having facilities that can adequately support human life in those areas. Sometimes they're just mud area, patches of mud or land. In most cases, the protocol is that there should be adequate services for food and shelter and clothing. I think the government missed the mark, or the teams missed the mark, in establishing a procedure that would take into account gender concerns, because what ended up happening was you have some 200 women with either infants or pregnant and almost 100 young babies and you know, toddlers in the camps with no specific care, no medical care available to them, no prenatal training for the mothers, no access to the kinds of services that someone who is pregnant would ordinarily have. So I think, you know, the lack of a gender sensitivity in the planning process has shown some of the flaws in the implementation so far. All that said, despite many delays and, you know, inadequate conditions in some cases, the FARC has basically stepped up to the plate and pitched in to help make the zones habitable for their troops. And I think there continues to be goodwill on both sides to make this work and to make it work going in the right direction. So I think that's one positive aspect of what's happening now.
Where else do you see signs of progress?
Another area that I would highlight is that the bilateral ceasefire is holding. I mean, the war between the FARC and the government really has been suspended. The guns have not been turned over yet. That's anticipated for the end of May. And the guns will be turned over, and the UN will house them and ship them off to be converted into three monuments that will be put up in Cuba, where most of the talks took place, New York, where the UN, at the UN, which has played a critical role in this last stage especially, and some unknown location within Colombia.
So with all this in the works, what other parts of the peace agreement are still pending or have yet to be implemented?
The end of the war is really already in sight. It's already taking place. What has not moved forward yet and what is yet to come is the transformation of Colombian society and the addressing of the causes of the conflict to ensure that the conflict will not come back. So you have the agenda items that were agreed to and the plans for action on each of those points that still need to be implemented. First of which is the rural agrarian reforms and development. The second is political participation, and there has been a working group that has put forth some recommendations for electoral reform. There is a statute of opposition that provides basic protections for those who are those politicians and opposition movements that oppose the government. This guarantees that they have a right to speak and that they won't be, you know, the government won't go after them and try to intimidate them into silence. So this is, I think, a critical part of reinvigorating Colombian democracy. The third area is the question of drug trafficking and illicit crops, and programs have already begun, joint programs between the FARC and the Army and communities to look at alternatives for coca cultivation and to map out plans for development in these areas that include things like tertiary roads and services, loans, and opportunity for people to really find an alternative form of income. And this is a particular concern because the numbers for the coca production in Colombia have skyrocketed in the last year. But I would just urge the governments to work hard to make the peace plan work on this front, because I think it's something novel to bring the communities into the planning process and to work with them to find the proper development model that will work in their communities. So it may take a little bit of time, but I would just caution that the increase in coca is not a result of the peace process, and it's not a result of the peace accord, because the peace accord has not really gone into effect yet. The fourth area is the question of victims, and the peace process and the peace accords created a very innovative structure that guarantees that the parties that are responsible for gross violations of human rights will not go without punishment. There will be no impunity for war criminals in Colombia. This has been a very controversial program, but it includes several kind of mechanisms to ensure accountability. First, it has a peace tribunal that will hear the cases of those accused of war crimes. There is reduced sentencing, but there is a privileging of truth-telling in the process. A second element of the justice and peace structure is a new truth commission, and this was just announced this week, so that's moving forward. That was an executive decree that came out of Santos's office, along with the creation of a unit for the search for disappeared people, which is also something that I think is an area where, you know, in the same way that you see in Mocoa, the desperation of people who have lost loved ones and can't find loved ones. It's not that they know what's happened, but the kind of I think the painful human agony of the whole concept of disappearance, where somebody is suddenly gone and you don't know, you're not able to mourn their death because you don't know that they're actually dead. Mm-hmm. So the hope is ever present. And I think this unit for the search for missing people promises that every family will have a report on what happened and there will be an effort made to find each individual that has disappeared. And the numbers in Colombia are heartbreaking. It's something like 60,000. There are different numbers from different entities, but that seems to be an agreed upon figure from the Legal Medicine Institute, for example, and that's higher than even in Argentina in the darkest days of the dictatorship and the disappearances that we all heard about in the 80s. It pales next to the Colombian case.
So in the middle of all this, Colombia is gearing up for presidential elections. Next month in May, everybody who wants to run in 2018 will have to declare their candidacy. You wrote that, quote, "the divides between political parties appear to be deeper than were the divides between the parties around the peace tables at Havana." So is Santos closer to Timoshenko these days than Alvaro Uribe?
That's a good question. I think I would say, I'm not sure that he's close to Timoshenko at all, but I think that you had a relationship built over the course of 4 years of hashing out differences at a peace table rather than shooting each other. And I think that process has left a process intact whereby FARC and government can discuss, disagree, and find a solution to problems. I think I was referring to the Centro Democrático, the party of the former president, Álvaro Uribe. I think it's been very difficult to even have him sit in the same room with Santos. We saw him engaging in the rewriting of the second peace accord, and he gave a lot of constructive inputs, I think. I think many people had inputs to give, and I think the government worked with the inputs that he gave. But there were a couple of red lines that the government was not able to get the FARC to cross, namely jail time for the FARC and political participation. And just to kind of give a little bit of a comparative lens here, ordinarily when you end a civil war and the parties become part of the same fabric of civil society, the idea is that they give up their guns and they have a voice to make their needs heard or their ideas heard, that doesn't require them to carry a gun. So I think the rigidity of those who basically said, we're not going to let them into our Congress, we're not going to, we're basically not going to accept peace unless the FARC are in jail, they lost. I mean, so you have a kind of a situation where now Uribe and his party actually has incredible power to undermine the implementation of the agreement that was reached between the Santos government and the FARC. This is an agreement that was crafted over time. It was not an easy agreement to reach. The transitional justice provisions alone took 18 months to agree to between the parties. And then to come back to Colombia and renegotiated all over again, but taking into account a kind of a shifting political environment, I think was absolutely necessary. But we haven't yet seen Uribe come to the peace table. So he remains on the outside. And I think the big difference you had with the FARC and the government was that both sides agreed that they wanted to end the war. And we haven't seen a kind of social pact yet or a political pact yet that the parties, the government needs to implement the peace accords, because signing an accord is really not the key. Implementing the accord is the key. And half of all peace agreements that are signed end up 5 years later with the parties back at war.
Where would you say, you know, behind the leaders, the figureheads that we see, where are the Colombian people these days? What are the different kind of the groups or the divisions of public opinion that you've seen?
Well, a political campaign for congressional seats and the presidency has begun. So there's a lot of manipulation going on by everybody to try to get people on their side. And it's very hard from outside especially to measure the temperature of what people are thinking and doing. There was a demonstration this week that Uribe was responsible for organizing, that I understand had good turnouts. there are many people organizing around peace issues. I think not so much in the streets yet, but there are a number of big demonstrations planned for the upcoming months.
Demonstrations in favor of peace.
Demonstrations in favor of the peace accords and in favor of implementation. And I think many organizations have stepped up to the plate with their ideas and with help, offers of help to try to implement different pieces of the agreement. There are many new structures and mechanisms that are being put into place. But it takes a while because the peace agreements actually have provisions that create dozens of new organizations that will be responsible for overseeing implementation, for monitoring implementation. And I think that's, you know, this will all be implemented in the regions outside of Bogota mostly. That's where the real peace will have to hold as ex-combatants go back to the villages, as victims confront sometimes people who were involved in harming them in profound ways. People will be trying to navigate these new systems for justice and historical memory to try to learn what happened in their communities, to document what happened, to hold people accountable for what happened. You do have a parallel process going on very, very quietly of recognition of wrongs done and harms committed in particular situations. In Putumayo, with the 11 Congress people who were kidnapped and held by the FARC, most recently in the Club Nogal bombing. So you have kind of processes going on behind the scenes that are not seeking the attention of or the limelight of the media. They're just very quiet initiatives that are trying to build peace in Colombia on the ground. So it's very interesting. There are many innovations happening, and many peace initiatives that I think will teach others in other conflict zones new ways to try to move from war to peace.
Such a mammoth task.
Certainly is.
So, pulling out a little to the international community, what are some of the roles the international community can take as Colombia is going through this process? And in particular, I know the U.S. Congress is reviewing its budget and the aid allocated under the Peace Colombia Agreement. What would be your pitch to Capitol Hill as they review this funding?
Well, I think the Congress should continue to support the peace accord implementation. Congress has been supportive and in a bipartisan fashion of the plan, the peace plan, and the peace process moving forward. We had a special envoy that was sent down to Havana to accompany the negotiations and to assist, and did in fact assist on numerous occasions in helping the parties over certain humps. I think it would be important for the Congress and for the executive branch as well to monitor the implementation of agreements, to make sure that both parties are held accountable for what they've promised. I think there's a role for the international community to support independent, autonomous civil society groups located in the regions where implementation is taking place to be the kind of watchdogs to make sure that the parties are held accountable for implementing what they say that they will do. I think also we haven't talked about the peace process with the ELN. The ELN is just about to finish a round of negotiations with the government, and there's every hint that they will hopefully have a humanitarian agreement around the issue of demining. In the FARC government process, you saw numerous kind of confidence-building measures, particularly around demining and clearing of coca cultivation, coca fields, that were joint endeavors between the Colombian army and the armed group, the armed insurgent, along with members of the community and some international accompaniment. The Norwegians have been particularly strong on the demining initiatives. So these kinds of engagements where you create scenarios to work together and to begin to build trust between the parties, I think are incredibly important during the peace process before you get to a final agreement. So I'm keeping fingers crossed, but word is that they may have an agreement, and I'm hoping that that indeed does come through. I think the other area where the U.S. government in particular, but the national community more broadly, can be supportive is to keep track of what's going on with human rights monitors. We've seen in the last year an escalation of killings of human rights monitors. These are folks who put their lives on the line to document when people are killed. And we've seen more and more that these people are often, you know, the more marginalized sectors of the population to start. They're the Afro-Colombians, the indigenous women. They're people trying to lay claim to their lands that have been stolen. They're people who have been supportive of the peace process. They're people on the left politically. In particular, members of the Marcha Patriótica, which is an entity that was set up before the end of the peace process as a potential area where there might be a place for the FARC to go politically, or at least a place that would support alternative visions. So when people from the political left are being targeted, I think that's a real warning sign, and it's a real concern that suggests that the government may not be able to protect the demobilizing insurgents. And if the government can't protect those insurgents, you're looking at a return to war. I know there's discussion of cutting the UN budget, but it couldn't come at a worse time for Colombia's peace process. It's really a national security interest. It's in the U.S.'s national security interest in the end to have a peaceful Colombia in a region that potentially could explode on numerous fronts.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bouvier, for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening. For more, visit as-coa.org.